It's time for another episode of Game Warden Connection. Your resource for the outdoors. I hope you're ready. Because here's your host, Carlos Gomez and Joe Alexander.
And there's no prettier sky than Oklahoma. When a duck comes down through that clear Oklahoma sky, there's nothing on the planet like it.
Welcome to Game Warden Connection. Carlos and I are eager to jump headfirst into the wonderful world of waterfowl, right here in the heart of America. We are lucky enough to have met up with some passionate waterfowlers this episode who share their views on duck hunting in Oklahoma. There's so much information that we have in this, we just have to have a series. So you don't want to miss a single one of these episodes. So sit back and let's get into the show. The first in our cast of characters is Big Hugh McLaurin of Ellery, South Carolina. Hugh has been in pursuit of ducks for nearly six decades, and this man is the one behind Big Lake Duck Calls. His passion is apparent, and he obviously loves traveling the Sooner State for waterfowl. He's going to give us a history lesson and some solid tips for anyone duck hunting today. Here's Hugh.
Yeah, if you go back to the history of waterfowl in North America, all the rice culture was on the East Coast. South Carolina had most of it. And there's a sign on the coast, I'd never seen it, said this was the rice culture of the world, was right here, or certainly of North America. Mm-hmm. And of course, with slavery, everybody's so glad that ended. The rice culture ended almost the same day. And it's, I don't know how long it took, but it slowly drifted to a little place called Stuttgart, Arkansas. If mm-hmm. you go there, they say, we're the rice culture of the United States now. Mm-hmm. And our ducks stayed around for about another 100 years. And then about late 1990s, for the most part, our flyway dried up. We had ringnecks through about 1997. The mallards dried up, 1993 or 4. Now, we still get a few. Mostly wood ducks. If you see a wild duck, it's a ringneck problem. So, you know, you've heard of places like Pamlico Sound, Chesapeake Bay. That's all on the East Coast. And they had so many ducks, they could kill them and sell them for food in places like Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Well, that's dried up. But we still have the passion in our veins. And I can remember hunting our local lake, which is called, the nickname is Santee. The real name is Lake Marion. We had 100,000 mallards or ducks on the refuge, 40,000 migratory geese. Now we have about 400 migratory geese and maybe a couple thousand. It's just the Atlantic Flyway is dried up. Now the Mississippi is pretty much dried up. You still have some really good days. And now all of a sudden, ye gads, Arkansas is drying up.
So take a pause for a second and explain to me why you think the East Coast dried up, why you think the Mississippi is drying up, and then go back and tell me about Arkansas in your perception.
Civilization on the East Coast, I think, maybe is the biggest thing. Our lakes are different from Oklahoma. If we have a nice lake, which we have a lot of them, there's a house on almost every square foot of it. If you go to Oklahoma, every lake has no houses. And y'all preserve those lakes for public use, hunting and fishing on north, south, east, west for most of them. Hardly any of them have refuges. A few do. So you hunt the whole lake if you can find a duck. There's roads in from the east. There's roads in from the west. And we just don't have that. Our lakes have got lake houses on them. You know, some of them are million-dollar homes. And nobody's ever seen that. I went to Kansas and saw the same thing at Lake Milford. And they planted around the lake and left, I think, 25% for the outdoorsmen. That would be for pheasant and ducks. And, you know, everything's bigger and better in the west. And I tell people it's like gold in the mad gold rush. They say, well, if you want to find gold, go west, young man. And if you want to find greenheads and wild ducks, you're going to have to either go north to Canada or North Dakota or west. And for most of us, Arkansas is a 12-hour drive. And that's where most people go. And I think a lot of them don't care. I mean, they care, but if they don't kill ducks, they'll just say, well, we missed it, but we got to go to Max, and we got to go to R&T, and we had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great time, and let's go again next year. We just missed the flight. But if you go one state over, if you cross Fort Smith into Oklahoma, you go from a 4-miler limit to a 5-miler limit. Now, that really appeals to me. And y'all have ducks.
Mm-hmm.
But now Oklahoma's starting to dry up some.
Well, I think you've heard, have you not, that Oklahoma is number two, only behind Arkansas, as the most
right.
number of non-resident hunters per capita hitting our state.
Yeah. It's
in the nation.
And I see it, you know, and I've had some friends of mine out there really fuss me out. Said, you're telling all these people back south, you're selling duck calls and telling everybody to go to Oklahoma. I said, I'm not. But, you know, you have a great service on the internet. You have a waterfowl survey for each lake. And that's what you call an internet hunter. And they just check the internet. That's how I found out about Oklahoma. I hunted Kansas 2 years in a row. We did real well the first time, real mediocre the second. And somebody said all the ducks are in Oklahoma. Well, how do you know that? This is like, I don't know, 1990, probably 2001 or something like that. And they said, well, they put it on the internet. And I really didn't know how to go find it, but eventually I learned it. And I said, doggone, it's Fort Cobb. Well, I could have told them they had ducks because I was there last December, January, but here it is posted on the internet.
Well, everybody and, likes their tourism, you know.
Yeah, so that's one thing. If you're okay with them coming in the state, that's probably the biggest reason is. And gosh, you have a WMA booklet. When I bought that, they threw in a free lake book, and they're what about 20 inches tall and
that was a nice book. Wow.
Yeah,
those you are kidding though.
Those lake atlases, those are nice books.
And yeah, they give you they gave me a free lake atlas. And almost all the lakes are publics. A few aren't, like Chickasha. I think that's closed. Maybe Lake Elmore's closed. That's a refuge. But almost all of them are open to hunting. You know, no houses, no refuge. I don't know. It's just it's a hunter's dream. It's just a paradise.
Just low population over here compared to East Coast, I suppose.
Right. A friend of mine showed me, he's a big turkey hunter, and I said, I just can't figure out what happened to the ducks. And he pointed me to a website, and it was the fluorescent lights in America. And the East Coast was lit up from, you know, Boston all the way down to Savannah. Mm-hmm. I said, well, there you go. If I was a duck, I wouldn't want to land there either. All these lights.
Yeah, I've never heard that, but I could see where that could have some sort of effect.
Yeah. I know we've seen the satellite imagery, and it certainly is lit up pretty hard on the East Coast.
Yeah. Now, a goose doesn't care. He can land on a golf course. But, I mean, they care, but they can eat turf grass. They can eat – but a mallard, he can't stand it. He's got to have a place where – and that's another thing is on the East Coast is everybody's got a mud buddy, a go devil. I mean, these kids have got $100,000 – truck and boat combos and they're still in high school.
I see that here. So how are they pulling that off? Because I couldn't do that when I was in high school.
I don't know. I mean, 20 years ago, our first trip to Fort Cobb, there was one other boat there, and they were from Louisiana. And now you go, and doggone, maybe, you know, four or five boats at the landing. But now in South Carolina, there can be 200 rigs at the landing.
Wow.
And there's not 200 ducks. And, what they're doing here is they're growing ducks. It's a wild strain, but they're captive ducks, and they grow them in these chicken houses, and people buy them in June, July, put them in what they call a little refuge pond, and feed them either Purina duck chow or Statesburg or whatever. It's another one, but they have this duck chow, and they'll feed them all summer. And when their wings grow out, they've got a corn pond. They'll flood it and stop feeding the ducks. But sometimes they'll actually walk to the duck pond. They won't even fly.
Huh.
And people shoot those in the fall. That's called the Frost Mallard Release Program.
So is that a state program, or is that a commercial thing?
I think it started in Wisconsin, but it's very well known. And so people will put those out, and I hate to say it, but they're actually act as live decoys, and nobody's ever said it was illegal. And it does attract a few wild ducks, you know, mostly ringnecks, and they're paying up to $15,000 a blind to hunt these things.
Wow.
It's just my son's and his father-in-law has one in his 2000 there. But you go and they've dropped our mallard limit from 4 to 2. But if I go to Oklahoma, the limit's 5.
Yeah.
So we've got a 2 mallard. So they'll go and shoot 2 release mallards, eat a great breakfast, kill the breakfast, and kill 2 ducks, and say, "Man, we had a great time." Mm. And I do it too. I said, "Yeah, man, it's better than sitting home and doing nothing." And so you're just having to travel further and further to find really good waterfowl hunting. And at times it can be really strong in Oklahoma, but it's been a little bit tough the last couple of years. Right. Right. I know in Arkansas, I've read a couple of articles where they're just literally sick because for them it's generational. You know, you go to the flooded timber with your grandpa and your son and your grandson, and they're saying, "Now we go and don't shoot the gun." And you know, this is like the epicenter of mallard hunt. And I got a friend that we hunted in Mississippi with 20 years ago, and he has flooded corn in Mississippi, didn't shoot the gun. They had leased land in Arkansas, didn't shoot the gun. And I mean, what does he do? Where does he go?
Yeah, I've heard that throughout the years that, you know, in the recent past that Arkansas is nothing like it used to be.
Right, right, right. And we're just chasing a dream. We're confirmed duckaholics, like Phil Robertson said. It has caused many a man to lose his job and caused divorce. See them pretty green things. And there's no prettier sky than Oklahoma. When the duck comes down through that clear Oklahoma sky, there's nothing on the planet like it, unless it'd be Colorado. And I just hadn't gone that far west. But
right.
There's such clear sunshine. And, oh, my gosh.
Ben Half is an Oklahoma game warden stationed along Fort Gibson Lake in northeast Oklahoma. You might think Ben is just a game warden, but don't let that pressed uniform fool you. He's a very avid duck hunter. In fact, he's hunted most parts of northeast Oklahoma all his life. He's even done research for Delta Waterfowl back in his college days, and simply put, Ben knows ducks. So here's Ben. So Carlos and I are sitting with a special guest. We've got Ben Half with us. Ben Half is a game warden in the state of Oklahoma. He's stationed in the Wagner County area, and that's near Fort Gibson Lake, if anyone is familiar with that area. So, Ben, welcome to the podcast. Appreciate you coming in and sitting in with us.
Well, I appreciate the invite.
So, give us some tips or pointers, or maybe as a hunter, as a duck hunter, waterfowler especially, give us some information about what you need to have as a duck hunter, or maybe is there any special laws or rules or anything like that as a duck hunter you need to know, whether you're a resident or non-resident?
Okay. And so, Joe, just to add a little quality to the conversation, or a little experience to my list here, not only do I work around an area where there are a lot of waterfowl hunters, there's a lot of public land, and I make a lot of waterfowl contacts where I'm at. I'm a duck hunter myself, and I have been for, you know, around 25 years. So, right. And one thing I think that's interesting about my story is that I didn't really grow up, you know, as a youth, waterfowl hunting. Mm-hmm. And so I see a lot of folks out there now that are new hunters in general, and then I see new waterfowl hunters. And these are people that are, you know, young adults often, but sometimes not. And they're trying to learn a craft without a mentor. And I won't say I've been in those shoes exactly, because when I was introduced to waterfowling and became a duck hunter, I was around some others who were already duck hunters. But I'm not someone that was born into a household where we duck hunted.
Right.
I picked that up later in life myself. So I can relate to some of the challenges that are in front of people like that. And I can hopefully through this offer some insight about, you know, what I've seen work for people, what I've learned to do myself, and, you know, my experience as a game warden and making these contacts. I'm also seeing where people are tripping up. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously there's a faction of the public that don't take care and try to follow the rules. They're, you know, they're rule breakers, but let's pull that group out. And I'd like to talk about where folks that are probably trying to do their best to follow the rules and go hunting and not, you know, not cause a problem, but somehow they're either not understanding the regulations or they're putting themselves in positions that they're likely to fail, et cetera.
And Ben, just to bounce on to you more along the lines you're saying, in my years as a game warden, one of the most disheartening experiences is to run into a new sportsman that's hunting with other sportsmen, and those guys that have brought along a new guy did not take the time to teach him or talk about a checklist or go over the things that he may need to make sure he's doing everything right. And he's with experienced sportsmen, so he thinks he's doing it all right. He says, I've got this and that, and they said, okay, let's go, and off they go, and there's nothing that has spoiled a new budding waterfowler or a lot of other different pursuits, but we're talking waterfowl, like a guy that's getting a ticket. I mean, it just turns a guy off when you're trying to do it right and you're learning and you're obviously not aware of all the different details you should be aware of, and then find yourself getting a ticket. It's a bad taste in your mouth.
No doubt. And you know, you've been there as a game warden. You're part of your job is to sniff that out and understand who you're talking to. Even if there's a violation, you want to understand how much intent was behind it, you know, how much of it was an oversight or an accident, or, you know, all of those things go into how you take care of that situation. But one of the ways I'm taking care of it is taking an opportunity in this format to provide some information. So if you're a listener and you're new or relatively new to waterfowling, one of the first things I want you to understand is that pursuing ducks or geese and hunting waterfowl in general is something with a whole lot of regulation. And I often make the comment, and I'm kidding, but I'm really not. I don't write rabbit hunters a lot of tickets. You know, rabbit hunters, there's not a whole lot of regulation. There's a regulation on how many rabbits they can take in a day. They're required one license, and they need to have permission to be where they're at. So yeah, it's only three strikes. And, right. and these guys that are pursuing waterfowl, they've got hours of the day they can hunt or not hunt. They've got several different species that are in that window, and some of them have different, you know, limits than others. They need to know different sexes and obviously the difference in ducks and geese and which ones are in season.
State
and
federal regulations.
State and federal regulations.
Layers of rules.
And then these areas where they hunt are highly regulated to provide opportunity was the original intent. But there might be a closed area here and an open area there, or this place might close at a certain hour of the day, mm-hmm. which might be different than that property over there. There's quite a few places to get tripped up. So if you're coming into this and you're excited about it, that's a great thing. But take your time and really learn the overall regulations and then what might be more specific regulations for where you're going. And if there are questions, you know, there are avenues to get them answered. Just going to the internet or asking someone you know that might have duck hunted at one time may not be the best thing. So I encourage you to find an agency professional near where you intend to hunt and reach out to that person and see if you can get, you know, whatever specific questions you've drummed up answered. And off the top, I want to talk about a couple of tips I have that might, you know, speed up that process or help a hunter.
All right, great.
So one of the things that waterfowl hunters are challenged with getting right is the shooting hours for the day. You know, they're allowed, they can't shoot ducks any earlier in the morning or any later in the evening than the shooting hours provided.
Sounds simple enough.
It is simple enough. And it's down to the minute, right?
Down to the minute.
Right. So early in my career, when we got started, your shooting hours for the day were spelled out in a regulation booklet on a table. Mm-hmm. And it was a general table for a location in the central part of the state in Oklahoma City. And you had to look at that table and then determine, okay, on, you know, December 12th, I can shoot at this time. But wait a minute, I'm east of that.
Right.
So I had to subtract, you know, minutes for that.
Fine print at the bottom of that table.
Exactly. Right. And it was very difficult. And honestly, from an enforcement standpoint, there was quite a bit of leeway in play there.
Yeah,
it was
tough.
But as a duck hunter, if you did your math and you had it right, and then the blind down the shoreline, they're shooting, say, 7-8 minutes early, that's frustrating. You know, you're wanting everyone to follow the same rules. Mm-hmm. And let's fast forward to now, you know, in your pocket for most hunters, and definitely in every single blind I come to, everyone has a smartphone. That equipment is there, and on that phone, everybody has a time. And that mm-hmm. time is accurate. It's not like the days of the wristwatch that might have been running a handful of minutes behind or
right.
et cetera. So it's accurate there. And then there are several apps that folks use for land ownership information that have pictures and I'm not going to use their names, but that, you know, they have your maps, they have your landowners, they have all these different public options and everything on there. All of those also have sunrise and sunset tables.
Right.
And they're not just tables. They know where you are. You can scroll down for that location and see what time is sunrise today. Mm-hmm. So use those tools to be highly accurate on when you can shoot and when you need to stop shooting. So I know that was a lot of fast talking.
The game warden would probably be using that table when he's calculating
absolutely
what he's yeah. going
to
do with
and,
you,
and right? we'll take it to the courthouse if we need to. So yeah. but it's easy. It's already in your hand. If you need some information on how to get, you know, better with it, then practice and reach out to somebody like myself and we'll get you that information. But that tool is there. It didn't used to be, and it's great. Okay. Another way that I see our hunters trip up is just the licensing. That in Oklahoma, we require a general hunting license. We also require a state waterfowl license, a harvest information permit, and a HIP is what that's, you know, commonly referred to as, and then, you know, a federal duck stamp. And most states are going to have a combination like that where there's multiple licenses that you need. So if you're a deer hunter and you're going to pick up and go duck hunting with some friends, mm-hmm. you know, you'll want to make sure that you're appropriately licensed because there may be several pieces of that puzzle. In Oklahoma, all of that's available through our online license portal now, you know, Go Outdoors Oklahoma. And so that's never been easier than now. You just log in and make sure you have all those boxes checked.
So address the stamps while you're talking licensing. Address the stamps about signing the face of the stamp and about having a stamp at all.
Well,
it might be a receipt where they bought it and they don't even possess a stamp.
So the federal waterfowl stamp, historically, you would go to the post office and buy your stamp. And it's literally a stamp that you could peel off of the card and mail something with is what it, you know, would be like. But and the federal law is always required that you sign your name across it. And that's because when you buy it, it's not printed with any of your information. It's a general stamp. And that way you personalize it and we know that they're not being shared. Through that online system I described, if you were to buy the federal stamp, it gives you credit for having it. It shows in your license credentials that you have it. But the actual stamp will be in the mail on the way to your home, whatever address that you put in there as your address. So there's a grace period, Carlos, where when you've bought the stamp but you haven't received it in the mail, you may still hunt as long as you can provide that credential that you have it. And after a certain period, then you're required to actually have the stamp on your person.
And your license profile from ODWC would also indicate that if you bought your stamp through the Wildlife Department, it's going to show that on your profile. Correct.
Correct. Now, if you went to the post office and bought one and then you just didn't have it that day, then we're not going to have any way of looking that up in our license system that you had it. So you need to carry it on your person once you actually get it in the mail or if you recover it from a third-party source like that. And then a little more about stamps without getting too far in that rabbit hole. Stamps are designed or intended that funds generated from stamps go right back into waterfowl. They go back into wetlands. They go back into managing for ducks specifically and other waterfowl. That way we have those places and we're paying it forward, you know, in that conservation that we'll have these resources for years to come.
Well, regarding the stamps, probably the last question before you move on down your list that I have is, I never was a hard ass, but I understand that you guys would write a ticket if it wasn't signed. You still do that? What's the status on that?
You know, I'm not going to. In 15 years, I've learned that there's not a hard and fast answer on every single violation you encounter.
That's
so
very true.
I definitely feel out the situation. If I feel like folks are sharing a stamp, if I've got an outfitter that's got a handful of clients and it looks to me like a group set of stamps are passed out every morning, then somebody's getting a ticket and somebody's going to see the judge. If it's a novice person, they've bought their stamp, they've got everything else correct, and it looks to me like they just missed the fine print that they needed to sign and personalize their stamp, many times I've pulled a pin out of my shirt and said, here you go, you need to sign that. And they're absolutely willing to do that. And it's an education moment for what the law was, what it's intended for, and we're all able to move on. So.
Yeah, all officers are going to be different, you know. It really depends on a lot of that, but... Yeah, there's been a lot of educational moments out there in the field where you hand somebody a pen and you say, here, sign that for me and save yourself some money.
Yeah.
You know, and then drive on.
Well, the nature of the contact tells you a whole lot about who you're dealing with on that, I suppose.
Yeah.
What's the next on your list?
Well, and you know, we talked about shooting hours, talked about licensing. You know, there's some equipment regulations. They're hunting around the water, figured out a long time ago that lead shot in the water creates problems for lead poisoning in animals. So your waterfowl hunters are using non-toxic shot. And a lot of the areas where waterfowl are found, even if you were hunting some other small game, if you're using a shotgun and shot, you're going to be required to carry a non-toxic. So if this is something you're new, you're into, you know, steel is the most common, but there's a variety of different non-toxics on the market. You want to make sure you have the appropriate ammunition. And in the firearm, if you're in the field pursuing migratory birds, your firearm may not be capable of holding more than 3 rounds of ammunition. So, you know, the general term or common way to do that is to plug the magazine, or that you may only put 2 rounds in the magazine, and then the third round would be in the chamber when necessary. So your gun needs to be legal. Your ammunition needs to be legal. Those are some things to think about for somebody new. Mm-hmm. Any question there, Carlos?
Having the spacer, I know, is important. Some of the firearms come with a spacer already, and if a guy's got the spacer in his gun, whether it came in the gun or he put a spacer in there, you know, I've seen the guy that had the end cap off of his magazine, and he was quickly shoving a pencil down as I was approaching. But there are a lot of guys that will say, hey, I'm only using 2 bullets. I'm not over using my ammunition and violating the plug thing. I'm only shooting 3 rounds in my gun. So, you know, there's always going to be that guy, I suppose, looking for the break.
Well, they can come up with a variety of excuses, and it goes back on a game warden investigating the scene like it always does. And so, you know, game wardens are known for being sneaky. And the reality is that the reality is that we spend a little time observing our hunters before we make contact. And so, yeah, there's no doubt a situation occasionally where somebody's in the blind with a gun that wasn't prepared. And sure enough, it doesn't have, you know, a plug in it or whatever in it. And it would hold more ammunition, but you're there and you didn't encounter them with too much in the gun. And you might be able to work with somebody under those circumstances. But again, you may also set back and observe a blind and watch the shooter on the north side of the blind shoot 5-6 rounds every time birds pass through. And now we've got somebody that's intentionally hunting with more than 3 rounds. And then both of those scenarios are going to be handled entirely different.
But the regulation is hunting with a gun capable of holding more than 3 shells. It doesn't say hunting with a gun that's not plugged.
That's correct. The word plugged is not used in statute. I'm using that as a layman's term. Right. I think most of the public can relate when I say that. I agree with you. The whatever the spacer is, it can vary. And in my guns, I try to use whatever that I can get from the manufacturer that's designed to fit that gun and achieve that purpose. But that's not the law. If you're found with the opportunity to hunt and you've got a gun that needs to be, improved where you can use it, made legal, then if you can make one out of a pencil or some other material, then that's what you need to do. I mean, I prefer to use something from the manufacturer just to keep from damaging my gun. But I'm like you. I've seen a pencil. I've seen a stick or piece of ragweed from the brush or whatever. Someone made it work. And then as long as the gun's legal, we're happy with that. Another thing I've seen, and this is a recent trend, are hunters that are using these land ownership apps. There's several of them out there. They're very popular. I'm a big fan of them. I use them myself. I use them working, and I also use them hunting. And these are the apps that show your location, and they show, an aerial photography of everything around you. They show who owns the land. They have different layers you can add. These are great tools for our hunters. But one area where I've seen these apps, I won't say they're causing a problem. One area where I see hunters are not doing their due diligence is they're trusting what they're reading on that app, and then they're going hunting based solely on information they pulled from that. And right here in Oklahoma, we have quite a bit of public land managed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. What I will say is catching these guys is there are also quite a few acres owned by the Army Corps of Engineers that is not open to public hunting. The same applies for state of Oklahoma. We have a lot of WMAs around the state. And if you look up on, let's say, OnX or any one of these apps, that land parcel may say state of Oklahoma. Well, if it's part of the public hunting area, then you can refer to, let's say, Fort Gibson Lake and look up the regulations for that public hunting area. But just because the owner is one of those government entities doesn't mean that that property is part of a public hunting area. And what I'm seeing, I'm catching this regularly in the fall now, is people are using the app and the base map, and they see that the land ownership is publicly owned, and they go in there and they hunt. And they're not looking beyond that at any local maps for area regulations. And I'm going to caution you to do that, because some of our areas that might be a waterfowl refuge would have closed dates from, say, October to the first day of February.
Right.
Well, if you just reference who owns the property, you're missing that area is closed. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they're not discovering that until I'm crawling in the duck blind with them, asking them why they're on the property. Right. And I'm getting these complaints from the public. There's no doubt I'm missing it. I'm not telling you I'm super game warden and I know where every blind is every single day. Other hunters are observing those closed areas. Mm-hmm. They're following the rules and regulations. And then when they hear the shotgun volleys over in the closed area, they're calling saying, hey, somebody's in there. And this unfortunately is happening over and over. And I can tell very quickly in the contact, these are folks that are not intentionally breaking the law, but they're using what is otherwise a great tool. They're just not doing their due diligence to back it up with an open public hunting area map. So, if you're listening and you're new to this, I highly recommend the ownership apps. I think they're great, and they have many, many tools that will help you be a better hunter. But always consult the local regulations for any public ground you're going to hunt.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. I would think caution a guy to make certain and to, like you're saying, his due diligence is to ensure that it's legal for him to be there, not is it illegal for me to be here? Because, we've had people that go hunting on Turnpike Authority property. We've had people that go hunting on school land. And like you said, if some app says it's owned by the state of Oklahoma, that doesn't make it public hunting ground.
Right.
Now, they've got to back it up with that public hunting area map. And like where I'm at, when they call me and they want this or that specific, the first thing I do is reference them to the Corps of Engineers map, and just a quick Google search, Fort Gibson Lake, public hunting area map. and bingo, several maps pop up, but the right at the top of the list is that core map, shows all those areas. Right. If I was comparing that to the ownership app, I'm also going to see many additional acres around the lake that the core owns, you know, through flood control or whatever reason they have it. But because of its vicinity to a neighborhood, or perhaps it's some kind of refuge, or a variety of reasons, mm-hmm. it's not open for public hunting. And I'm getting those complaints, honestly. Right. It's you know, I'm all about hunters finding little places that are out of the way to get in a good hunt. I totally support the guys that go the extra mile, use all the technology they can to find their own little private honey hole. And, you know, I say private, I mean their own little honey hole that's public, but they seem to be the only ones that have just sniffed it out and they're using it. But we've all got to play by the same of the rules, and some of these are just simply closed.
You know, it's been a year since I've been out of the game of enforcement, but I got to share with you on this note, probably the most common question and problem that I ran into around the metropolitan areas, and I suspect it might exist in lots of parts of Oklahoma, was the navigation channels or the riverways, you know, public waterways. A sportsman would look at that and say, well, the Arkansas River, it shows on the map that it's owned by the Corps of Engineers. And so they would naturally think that they could go hunt that, and they wanted to hunt that. And oftentimes, you know, they had to cross all kinds of private landowners to get to that parcel, or, you know, they found themselves in some area where we're getting complaint calls and we're having to investigate who's there and why they're there and what they're shooting at and all that sort of thing. My point is this: they need to be very cognizant of the fact that if it says, if someone tells you the river, quote unquote, the river is public, they need to understand that statutorily, by definition, the river is the liquid. That's the water. And a lot of folks that I have found over the years that I've had this interaction with believed that the sandbar was part of the river, believed that the logs and the substrate under the river was part of the river. And it's not. The river, by Oklahoma definition, is the water. It's the liquid. So for you to be hunting the river, if you're free drifting, or if you're, you know, somehow not touching the soil, then you might be on the river. But if your foot is touching the soil, like you probably stand on the soil, then you're on somebody's property. It's managed by the Corps of Engineers because they're managing the water flow. And it's the same way PSO might manage the electric flow on some high lines. But that doesn't give a person the belief that the soil under those high lines is public hunting ground. Just because it says GRDA on the high line doesn't mean it's hunting ground under the high line. So the waterway was literally public liquid, but the substrate is not public. That's typically private. So you need to know, you know, who owns the land, where you're coming from, who you're standing on. And for that matter, even if you're drifting in a canoe, if your pellets are raining down on somebody's private property, you're not staying on the river, because things are starting to rain down on somebody else's private property. So you end up with a lot of complaints of people that, hey, somebody in the river is shooting our barn or what have you, and it's because the river might be a narrow access point on the core land, but they can't really hunt that. So that's a point I want to emphasize to those folks around metro areas, is the liquid is what is public, not the soil.
Well, and Carlos, you really point a finger exactly at what I'm talking about. So the area itself, you know, and this may be localized. If you're listening to this and you're 500 miles away, there may be quite a few things that are different in your area, and it may not even really be all that relevant. But that's just something I've seen. I've seen it for a few years now, and those tools are new enough that we're all still finding our way, you know, around them and how to use them. And so I just want to caution someone new that although they're great for what they're intended for, they may not be the only resource you need when it comes to learning, you know, about a new area or gaining access to a new area. And, you know, into your scenario, I'm with the guys. Hey, I see ducks on the gravel bar and it's safely away from other structures or homes. I want to go hunt them too. I mean, I can put myself in those shoes. And I'll say this, duck hunters, they've enjoyed, at least in our area here in Oklahoma, a lot of freedoms. you know, you get that boat on the water, or even the guys that are driving around, there's a lot of acres here you can hunt. There's a lot of big reservoirs and long rivers and a lot of places where you get to make that decision. You're not married to one little parcel. You know, that's kind of why Oklahoma's so great. You can scout around and look at different country and different types of places and find ducks and go hunt them. So that freedom itself, you get in that habit of being able to cover ground, confirm that it's public, and go there. I'm asking the guys to do their diligence and take it one more step and seek out any local regulations that may be in play.
Well, it's real important to point out to everybody too that obviously we're kind of zoned in on Oklahoma here, Oklahoma Game Warden. We're in Oklahoma, but to any listeners in other states, just realize that you've got the federal layer of regulations and you've got the state layer of regulations. So know your state rules front and back, and then the federal rules should be pretty uniform across the country. But
well, and specifically on this topic, the private land ownership, whether it carries out underneath the water or whether it encompasses the, you know, surface acres of the water, that can vary state to state. I've experienced that myself in my own hunting and fishing endeavors. And so wherever you're coming from, you may be dealing with an entirely different set of rules when it comes to that state regulation. So be sure you're tuned up on what the local rules are and that what you're doing, your actions are compliant with that.
Correct.
Right. Yeah, Oklahoma, you know, we're pretty diverse and we got a lot of shoreline. I think there's something like 11,000 miles of shoreline in Oklahoma. So there's a lot of shoreline in Oklahoma. I don't know where we rank as far as amongst all the states in shoreline, but that's quite a bit. I know that like our biggest lake, I think, is Eufaula. I would say that it's up there, and then probably next is probably Grand Lake, and then maybe Broken Bow. Or
well, we only get half credit for Texoma.
Well, that's right.
We're sharing that with
Ula-Gaw's
Texas.
Ula-Gaw's number three.
Oh, is it? Ula-Gaw's number three? Okay.
So all these you just mentioned have public waterfowl hunting opportunities.
Oh, yeah. They're huge, yeah. Now,
the western half of our state doesn't have near the percentage of public access, but we're working on that. I don't know that we've mentioned our private lands access program or not. But I will. One of the things that Oklahoma's done in the last handful of years is go out and contact private landowners and gain some access for public land users through a contract program where there's some cost sharing there and they get some benefit from the agency. But they're opening acres of private land in areas of the state where we may not have, you know, a ton of public land. And what we're trying to do there is, you know, broaden opportunity, you know, statewide and not just where we have it in eastern Oklahoma with a lot of public, you know, we're trying to open some doors out there. And, yeah. And you know, here's a quiet little plug for small game hunters. Some of those can be some dynamite opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. We asked Hugh, since he had all this experience waterfowl hunting, is there anything he'd like to share to the new waterfowl hunter? Here's what he had to say.
Well, if you live in Oklahoma, to me, that's the promised land. You don't need a boat. If you got a boat, great. But there's so many walk-in spots. And get that WMA booklet. I go to GPS a lot. You know, there's a lot of places on these WMAs that there's a little pond or a slough or a creek. You can walk a creek. I've done it. There's never been any finer decoys than right now. If you can remember what they were like in the 1960s, they were terrible. Or you had to buy L.L. Bean Court decoys. So great decoys, great calls. The calls have never been any better or more inexpensive. You can buy a good double reed for $20. We make a really good wood duck call for $20. You need to carry a wood duck call. The limit's three. A lot of states, that's mostly what you're going to see. Great bird to shoot. But get familiar. Call your game biologist in Oklahoma. Their only interest is to help people. And they feel like if I can get somebody out in the field, that's just their dream come true. And maybe they spend a little money locally. I know I do. We stay in motels. We go out to eat every night. Just have a wonderful time. But it's so many opportunities. I have a young friend that started coming, I think because of me. And he said, Hugh, if you went to every lake, every WMA, it would take a lifetime to scratch the surface. I mean, you think of Eufaula, Grand American, or Grand Lakes of the Americas, whatever they call it.
Grand Lake of the Cherokees.
Yeah, I mean, cause fairly, you could say that's fairly small, but it's big. Some of these lakes are huge. Spavinaw. Pine Lake. I mean, I've never even been to some of those, and they're huge.
Well, and you pointed out something that I've seen. I've worked these waterfowl hunters in our state for 15 years, and one thing I've seen, and I do pass this on to anyone that will listen, is you're not always looking for the biggest stretch of water or the biggest spread of decoys. Right. And sometimes those little out of the way, I call them farm ponds, but little places out in the gist of the WMA that may not even be specifically managed for ducks. Those can be great little hunting areas. I'm around Wagner, Oklahoma, Fort Gibson Wildlife Management Areas in my backyard. That is, it's cattle country in general with some cropland agriculture around. And within the, I think we've got about 16,000 acres of public hunting area there. There's a wetland development unit, and then there's Fort Gibson Lake, which fluctuates and has pretty good waterfowl habitat. But throughout the WMA, there are dozens and dozens of little half-acre ponds and little sloughs on the creeks or just a place the beavers have backed up. And a lot of times those little spall opportunities are great to get away from pressure or great for someone that doesn't have 400 decoys. They can go put out 8 decoys brush in real easy and have a great hunt.
I know, and I'm gravitating toward their Lucky Duck makes a real light decoy. It's really looks great. I've got a lot of greenhead gear, the heavy plastic, and I carry them, but they're making these little light ones, and the real decoy company makes them. I mean, you just hold them in your hand. They weigh 4, 5, 6 ounces. Buy some of those, and get a decoy bag that's got shoulder straps and a little cross snap. Use your GPS on your phone. And when you find one of these places, I found one that it was on the map, but it showed a blue dot. And I thought, what's a blue dot mean? Is that a tank? And I went there one afternoon about 2:30, and I used my GPS. It was close to a mile. And when I got over the hill, that thing was absolutely full of gadwall, widgeon, pintail, not many mallards, ringneck, canvasback, redhead. And it's still one of the greatest places I've ever hunted, but it's been dry the last 3 years. So I'm just praying for a big rain that I can get back in there. But learn how to drop a pin. When you find a place like that, drop a pin and give it a little name. So-and-so WMA, Little Pond, or Little Slough, or Oxbow on the Creek. And then you've got a spot that you can go to. Say you drive from another state, you get there the first day, maybe you get there at noon, and you go to 4 or 5 of these places before dark, and booyah, 2 of them got mallards or got ducks from a previous scouting trip and hunting trip. And if they don't, then at least you're not going to waste a morning hunting it. And so it's just so much opportunity. I mean,
you're absolutely right. So look, these guys should be looking for gear that works for them, they can afford, gets them in the field. And then, yes, all of the technology has come so far with the ownership apps, the aerial photos on your phone. I know the app I use, I won't drop their name here, but you can go in and put notes on a waypoint. So for me as a duck hunter, not only will I put a waypoint or pin for this spot, I'll go down to that notes section and I'll write lake 3 feet above normal north wind, and I'll give myself some information where I look at this later, I know not just on the map where it is, but when I felt like it was the good time to hunt it or hide the boat able to stand in the trees in the water or whatever it is you wanted to do there.
Yeah, I've got some of the apps, but just your regular GPS that you use to drive with, you can go to 3D, I guess that's topographical 3D. And you can drop a pin and write in the save it and give it a name, or you can go to HuntWise or HuntX or any of those. But it's on your phone anyway.
Sure. No, these are great tips, Hugh. I appreciate that.
You know, if you don't know how to do it, then get a 5-year-old to teach you, because they'll know how to do it.
That's true.
But and then all season long, you know, I'm pulling them up, and I'm thinking, oh God, and just get back there. And I told Carla, I just got back from Africa. I killed Cape Buffalo and Roan and Sable, but I wouldn't trade my experience. If my wife said, you pick one or the other, I'd say, all right, I won't go to Africa, because I'm not giving up Oklahoma. It's just like, you know, going out there and prospecting for gold for me.
That's saying something right there.
Yeah, if you like greenheads, you're going to have to pretty much go to Oklahoma or Kansas. Kansas has more ducks, but they don't have the lakes. Now, on y'all's website, the state website says we have more lakes and ponds than any other state. And I tell people, I said, I have trouble believing that they have more than Minnesota. Let me tell you something. We have one Santee Lake. Everybody goes there to duck hunt. There's hardly any ducks. They have at least 100, maybe 200. And none of them have a house on them. Most of them don't have refuges. And it's just crazy.
You're talking about in Oklahoma.
Yeah. I mean, but I think Senator Redmond and those back in the 1930s said water is going to be the resource of the future. Let's build as many lakes as we can build. Plus, that'll help with our flood control.
Yeah, the flood control is a major factor on the infrastructure we have with the reservoirs.
Right.
And even into the western part of the state with smaller watershed type, you know, reservoirs that are not necessarily public. But yeah. I will say we probably have to give the fishermen some credit. There's a huge fishing heritage here in Oklahoma, especially around Tulsa. Gosh. And you mentioned right away about if you need a road on the east side of the lake, there probably is one, or need one on the west side. That access, those boat ramps in small places, even if they're just a little one lane deal with a real primitive, you know, location, we probably owe the fishermen credit over the years, the public wanting to get on the lake to fish, and that's infrastructure has been built and it's there. And for the small, you know, the duck hunter coming from far away with the little flat bottom boat, you probably can go a whole lot more places here than many other states.
We had a lot of county roads too, that checkerboarded across our state. And then when they flooded those lakes, they flooded up into those roads. So some of those roads provided ramps and things for us naturally.
Yeah.
But you know, like Canton, I mean, there's roads coming in from the east. There's roads coming in from the west, all up there around that feeder river, that Canadian river. Mm-hmm. And that some of them are miles long, and y'all keep them up. If trees fall down, eventually somebody's going to clear the road and plant food plots for deer. And we just don't have that here. We've got WMAs, and you can put in for the hunts. But not on every lake. I mean, just y'all have it on every lake.
Well, the point you make so well, Hugh, and I appreciate is, you know, I think probably every state has a gift and has something that's special about their state. And it's so common for those folks that live in a particular region to become so lackadaisical about it. You know, they take it for granted and don't even think anything about it. You know, mallards and greenheads is something we see and flush off a pond all the time, and the roads and the ramps and the upper ends of these lakes and things that you're appreciative of, you know, it's just everyday stuff for us.
Well, if you get out west, now I've hunted, the guy that showed me some water spots, he said, I used to hunt water. I don't. I take my clients from dry fields. I'll be glad to show them to you. And he showed me a couple of spots on Cobb. And we just had a wonderful time. But he said, you know, I call out the farmers. And he started hunting. He's retired now, but he started hunting out around Eric because there's so many people hunting around Cobb. And he said, kill them all. He said, well, why don't you like ducks? He said, you plant 100-acre wheat or barley field and let 30,000 mallards, 30,000 white geese, 30,000 dark geese, and 400 Rios eat it, there's nothing left. I hate them all. Kill them all.
It's about the dollar, I guess, sometimes, too.
He said, they hate them. He said, and one of them said, he said, well, can we turkey up? Come back. Yeah. He said, but I want you to kill them all. He said, well, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said, we hate them.
We got to laugh about it.
And you're just thinking, God, I've just gone to heaven. I must have died and gone to heaven.
Man, have we just scratched the surface on waterfowl and duck hunting in Oklahoma. We're going to wrap up this episode with a few last words from Warden Ben Half. We hope you've enjoyed this episode because we've got a lot more coming in the following series. So stay tuned, and here's Ben.
Joe, I don't want to keep you all day. A couple things I want to squeeze in real quick. And it's going to come up over and over on this. Popularity of waterfowl hunting is way up, and it's way up in Oklahoma. And I'd like to ask that our duck hunters that are out there be mindful of how your ethics and your actions when you're in the field are affecting everyone around you. We're all in this together, and our goals are pretty much all the same. And so just because you could do one thing on a given day and have a successful hunt, you need to think about how your actions are affecting everyone else in the marsh or mm-hmm. the perception of what duck hunters are to maybe a non-hunter or some other person that's using the same body of water.
Right.
So I know when folks are not experienced hunters, all they think about is what they need to do right now, you know, to make a shot happen or mm-hmm. to have a successful hunt. When guys that have kind of been there and done that, seasoned hunters, they've learned to avoid actions that might step on the toes of the other hunters in the marsh, or they might avoid doing things that are considered rude. And so let's be cognizant of what we can do to enjoy our hunt, but not be that guy that's causing a problem in the marsh. And some things I'm talking about are, you know, shooting at ducks that are too high. You know, let's be ethical and make sure you've got them in the wheelhouse where you're going to make a good shot.
I don't think anybody would sky bust ducks, do you?
The fact that it's got a name and a term, that's a reality.
Where did that come from?
Setting up on top of somebody else. If there was a place you really wanted to hunt and it was kind of what you had in mind, but you get there.
But what if I got that twice barreled 10 gauge?
Well, let's not get in a shootout in the marsh over a couple of ducks. And I love to hunt ducks too. But if you get beat to the spot, you don't have a plan B. Have a plan C.
There you go.
That way you can just roll with the punches. If you get out there and someone beats you to the place, go to the next place. And just keep moving. Remember that the season lasts for a couple of months, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
Don't have to get it all done today. And try to remember, you know, to take somebody new with you. If you're one of those folks that's a veteran hunter, you've been there, done that. Look around in your community for some young guys that might need a little mentoring and maybe invite them with you or have them meet you there. And let's share some of the, you know, proper etiquette and some of the classic tradition and heritage that we've learned. Let's share it with the next group.
Yeah. You know, to me, duck hunting is not about killing ducks. I know that sounds weird, but it's more of the camaraderie of getting out there and setting up a good spread and maybe drinking a cup of coffee and visiting with your buddies. And, you know, when you see some birds coming, you know, you work the birds and maybe it works out. Maybe it doesn't, but it doesn't matter because you're having a good time.
It's a social function.
Well, it can be.
Well, it's definitely more social than, like, say, a deer hunt where you sit by yourself. Still as you can be.
And quiet as you can be.
You're not visiting. You're just stonewall still and trying to hide. And in this deal, we're in a blind or some other hide. And there's a couple of folks that you enjoy spending time with. And you're sharing whatever else is going on in your life. And you're talking. And, you know, hey, when the ducks interrupt you and you can shoot the great shot or watch the dog do his thing, that everybody's happy there.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, you're just spending time. You know, that magical sunrise, there's nothing better than a mm-hmm. wintertime sunrise. As far as sunrises go, those are the best ones. They really are. Yeah. And we're all in it for that. So I agree with you, Joe. And I'm going to tell you another thing. Oklahoma has been heralded lately as this wonderful waterfowl hunting destination. And we are seeing people come from all over to our state. And they're really getting out there. And some of them are having a great time. The reality is, and I hunt here a lot, not every day is a banner day.
Oh,
if you're hearing this and you think, true. Well, all I've got to do is burn some gas and get there and it's going to be Mallard City, let me let you down easy. It may or may not even be anything spectacular. Oh, I've seen days when it's as good right here as anywhere there is. But I've sure gone out there and floated some decoys and just had breakfast with them. So
I think I've been with you a couple times
on that. Exactly. So yeah. If you're in it only for numbers, you can't just show up anytime and expect that. So
right.
You really need to be in it to enjoy that camaraderie and that heritage of, mm-hmm. of what it is, and be willing to come and go and spend time and, you know, and be mobile. If you really are a numbers guy and you get to Oklahoma and it's not happening, get in the truck and go somewhere else, go north, go south, go wherever the ducks are.
Right.
If you're a local person, whether you're hearing this and we're talking about Oklahoma or you're in Nebraska or Nevada or wherever you hunt, you know, and you're thinking about getting into waterfowl hunting, you know, the more days in the fields you have, the more you learn about what the ducks do in your area, what weather can change or, you know, improve it or make it worse. And, you know, it's those hours that you're out there that will make a difference in your successes at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of factors, food, water, weather, pressure, you know, that all plays into it.
Yeah. Memories with a kid, memories with your lab.
Oh yeah.
Memories with, you know, a relative, a friend. Those are really the reasons to go. And the ducks are just kind of part of the excuse.
Let me touch on gear real fast. One thing I see, and it is the expertise of these businesses in the outdoor industry. They do a wonderful job with great pictures of the kind of scene that you'd love to be part of. You know, they've got their birds or they've got their good looking dog and you see this picturesque setting and you see that and you want that, and they're selling you things that are probably pretty good products. There's a lot of really good products on the market. There's when I started duck hunting, you didn't have, no amount of money you could go buy the kind of coat that would keep you dry and warm like what we have now.
Right.
And same thing with waders, same thing with decoys and calls. But what I would like to say is there is a fortune to be spent. And if you're not careful, you will go spend one, maybe even before you decide whether or not you like duck hunting. So as an experienced hunter myself and a game warden who's around duck hunters for a few months out of the year, don't buy in necessarily that you must have a $600 coat to hunt ducks.
Right.
You don't necessarily need $2,500 worth of decoys to have your day when you shot a bunch of ducks.
Or a $2,000 shotgun.
Or on up from there, Joe.
No, wait a minute.
So you do need gear you can depend on.
It's multi-uses, you know.
But a little strategy on your part will get you by with what gear you may have or may be able to afford at the time.
Right.
I'm big on investing in gear that I'm going to use over and over, but I think a person really needs to wade the waters a little here and make sure that this is something for them before they spend the family's, you know, monthly wages on a set of decoys or something like that.
Well, it goes back into mentoring and pairing yourself up with friends that have a dog or friends that have, you know, decoys and all the different things already. And like you said, give you a chance to kind of taste it before you decide if you're going to buy the whole cow.
Well, and one other tip I have here, and this might surprise you too, outfitters have their place. And I find whether it's fishing or hunting or whatever realm they're in, you'll see outfitters running a successful business whenever the activity requires specialized gear. So if you're not a duck hunter and you'd like to try it, I don't care where you're at, look around and find a reputable outfitter and consider maybe going on a guided hunt, because that way you're not buying a bunch of specialized gear that you may not even need later. If you go on a hunt and it's not your thing, you didn't spend money on waders and all these decoys and a boat ride. Folks may not even know how to drive a boat.
That's true.
We don't go driving boats in the winter around here. That's dangerous if you don't know what you're doing.
Absolutely.
So I want you to be thinking about that. And sometimes, you know, for a couple $100, you might go get that experience, one-stop shop, and see whether that activity is really for you. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what, just another strategy to get yourself in the field and understand what you're learning, what you're doing. If it is for you, then yeah, start making those investments slowly.
Yeah, I can geek out on gear just as much as anybody, but I'm telling you, when you get into the waterfowl deal, just like all the licensing and all the different things you have to have and the steel shot and you name it, you know, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And you can, you know, thousands of dollars later, you're about to go, you know, in the woods or, you know, on the water to try to go duck hunting. So, yeah, that's good advice. Well, try an outfitter.
And no amount of quality gear or fancy equipment and tools and bells and whistles will change the conditions
yes.
or the weather or what other driving factors make a difference. Those are the factors that make a difference of whether or not you're going to have a good day.
Right.
Those things make you comfortable. That might help you get access. They might make a difference on a marginal day. Mm-hmm. But the reality is when it's going to be a good day, you know, the gear isn't the change, you know, isn't the factor that makes a difference. It really isn't.
That's where you need to know how to count to six.
Well, and six is what? Six is a limit, right? In this state. Yeah. In this state. Yeah.
And apparently in other states, it's not like that.
No, so. And it's going to vary. So always check those regs for where you're going to be. Joe, I don't have much else. If you any questions for me specifically about anything I've discussed or anything you want me to shed light on?
No, I think you have. You shed a lot of light on all the opportunity in Oklahoma. You know, our season will begin here shortly, probably by the time this podcast airs. The first half of the season will kick off, and then we have a second half of the season later on. It's pretty lengthy season as far as that goes. So there's a lot of opportunity out there. All right, Ben, we appreciate you being on the podcast. I know you got a lot of work ahead of you as season nears. We got duck season rolling in. We got a deer season rolling in before too much longer for the rifle season. So there's a lot of stuff going to be going on. I know you're going to be busy, but we appreciate you taking time out of your day to sit in with us on this podcast, and appreciate you. Thank you. We appreciate the Wildlife Department for allowing you to come on and visit with us and visit with the folks and all the listeners. I know they're going to get a lot out of it. I know that we have. So we appreciate that.
Well, thanks again for having me. Anytime we can take a moment and share some insight or discussion and the public can benefit from that, I'm all in. So you guys are doing a great job with this. Keep it up.
All right. Thanks. Well, folks, that wraps up another episode. Thanks for listening to the Game Warden Connection podcast. You know, we set out to make this podcast a resource to help anyone get more out of the outdoors. And it doesn't matter if you're a hunter, fisherman, or an explorer. We're here for you. Do you have some questions? Or maybe comments? Please reach out to us on our website, gamewardenconnection.com, or on Facebook. And we'll do all we can to make a connection between you and an agency or industry professional. And along this journey, we'll find the answers you've been looking for. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review to help us grow and reach more people in our community. The views expressed on this podcast are solely those of the participants and not affiliated with any agency. And lastly, if you enjoy the outdoors, then pass on that tradition and introduce someone new to the wonderful experiences to be had hunting, fishing, and exploring. Until next time, folks, enjoy the great outdoors.